Welcome, everyone, to our second session with Professor Scott Hegley from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. The topic is Christianity for a post-Christian context, and it's proving to be a fascinating series. So we'll begin with prayer.
Thank you. Yeah, where's the echo coming from? Is it? Is it coming from the phone?
Is there an echo?
Yeah.
Make sure your phone's.
There we go. Oh. Now does that? Yeah. Is it still check? I don't hear it now. Are we good? Okay. It's like speaking if you've ever had to speak on a microphone in a stadium and you can like hear the, it's really, anyway, I'm glad we're not having to do that here. So let's pray. Gracious God, we give thanks for this morning. We give thanks for this community, for the many ways that they are responding to your Holy Spirit and being faithful witnesses to the gospel in this time and in this place. Pray that you would guide our conversation and help us to hear one another and to hear from you. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, so last week I warned you that we were going to do 2 weeks of bad news before we have 2 weeks of good news, I guess. We're trying to figure out what to do. But 2 weeks of kind of naming where we are, and then 2 weeks of thinking about what do we do going forward. So I'm using four to kind of name where we are. I'm using four different images of trying to think about what it means to be the church in a post-Christian or post-Christendom society. The first image was soil. So recognizing that American Christianity is a unique kind of animal, a unique kind of creature, a unique kind of plant, whatever metaphor we want to use. And part of that has to do with the soil in which our communities have been sown, or the soil that we have been planted in, if we want to use that language. The soil of legal disestablishment, and then subsequent kind of cultural disestablishments that have followed. And so this is a church community that has to function as a voluntary association that lives and exists in a competitive religious economy, and that has undergone a series of kind of cultural displacements over the last several years, last several decades as well. And so the soil in which we're rooted is shallow, we might say, uncertain, unstable. And that's just part of what it means to be a part of a religious community in the United States. In some cases, it's served us very well. It's led to entrepreneurial, creative kinds of ministries that make the United States unique in the West. We're more religious than other Western countries. But it also means that when things are unstable, they feel quite unstable, right? And that's sort of where we are now. The second image was water. So because we are a voluntary, because we function like voluntary associations, we have depended upon voluntarism. One of the things that has made the United States unique, again, among Western countries, is our rates of voluntarism have been really, really high. Going as far back as the 19th century, you've got Democracy in America. Alexis de Tocqueville shows up. He's studying the prison system in America. And instead, what he does is he writes about how democracy functions and the kind of riotous volunteering and association building that characterizes American life in the 19th century. Those rates actually increase through the 19th century. They peak in about the 1950s, and then they start declining in the 1960s. And you know, people like Robert Putnam and others have been reflecting on what does this mean that we have this? We're undergoing a massive loss of what he calls social capital in the United States. So if you've read the book, or you're familiar with the book Bowling Alone, which was late 90s, early 2000s, Robert Putnam, is tracks what he calls this massive loss of social capital. People are not building the kinds of associations they once did. They don't volunteer for the PTO. They don't volunteer, for door knocking with their, with a political candidate, and they don't volunteer for church. And so our churches have benefited for much of American history from large rates, high rates of voluntary activity. And the assumption that to be a good American and to be a part of my community means I volunteer. I give my time, I give my money, I show up, I, do that kind of thing. One of the assumptions has been is that, one of the reasons why we have such high rates of volunteering, one of the reasons why we have high levels of social solidarity and social capital is because our churches were so good at training and equipping volunteers. And I think part of what we have now learned is that churches depended upon volunteerism as much as they contributed to it. So one of the things I said right at the end of our time last week is that volunteering is both a vicious and virtuous cycle. So when there are high levels of volunteering, high levels of social interaction, high levels of social capital, that actually increases rates of volunteering. So you have a virtuous cycle. But when that cycle breaks, when there's low levels of social trust, when there's low levels of volunteering, there it becomes very difficult to sort of turn that tap back on, right? So where there's social trust builds volunteering, volunteering builds social trust. When social trust declines, volunteering declines. When volunteering declines, social trust declines. And it's hard to know sort of what causes what, right? That's sort of the argument now. How do we rebuild social trust? We don't really know. So congregations are caught up in all of the midst of this. So when people, even someone who considers himself a member of a congregation, or a regular attender of a congregation. What regular attendance means now is very different than what it meant 30, 40 years ago. Regular attendance now is showing up occasionally and maybe giving a buck or two. It's not serving on the committees. It's not coming every Sunday. It's not giving 10% of one's income. And this is not something that is the fault of the church. And it's not something that we can wag our finger and lecture people about either, because this is just now a cultural reality. How people think of their lives, how people participate in community has changed. And for a wide variety of reasons, right? It's not just, everybody's inside on their phones or whatever, or people are watching TV. Like, there's a lot of grumpy interpretations of why this is the case, but this is linked to a whole bunch of other things. Gig economy would be a big reason, right? The fact that you need two working parents to really raise a family at a middle class level is a another kind of economic explanation, and we can go on with other things as well. So the water, the source of life for our congregations, that spigot has been turned off, right? And so soil and water would be two sort of external. Two explanations external to the church that have dramatically changed how the church functions in society, right? And made it much more difficult for us to live life the way that we once lived. Another way to think about it is we are structured around a certain kind of relationship to the soil, relying upon a certain amount of water, watering, a certain amount of life-giving water. We are structured for that. This is what helps us grow. This is what helps us thrive. And both conditions have changed. The soil, it has worn away. The water spigot has been turned off. And so now we are, feeling the consequences of that. I want to pause and just any comments or questions about these first two images. And then what we're going to do is switch to images that are naming a little bit more of what's happening to us internally in our churches as well.
I have to admit, I will make a comment at this point. My name is Doug Mitchell, and I'm up in the ceiling. Anyway, What is it to be a Christian? I think the definition of it has declined in our expectations. We have not exhorted our members to be more active, to be more, better engaged. When we move, granted, we're up against a culture, but what are we doing in response? And I would list that as a personal and a corporate challenge to see to it that if someone becomes increasingly engaged, at least, what is our response? Do we encourage that person? Do we bring them tightly into the fold? I think we do a pretty good job at Westminster once we've made a few friendships with our new members. But that is, I think, our challenge, not to yield to the cultural expectations, but to continue to stay the course.
Yeah. I don't know if I should talk back to the ceiling. Is that
okay with me?
Thank you for that. One of the things we're going to talk about either next week or the week after is kind of a principle that comes from missiology around what we would call contextualization, which is that the gospel, by nature of the gospel, the word incarnate, you know, the word became flesh and dwelled among us, that there is always a cultural dimension to our understanding and our living of the gospel. There is no pure gospel that falls from the sky, right? There's only the word made flesh and then the word translated, right? And so part of the discernment of the church in every time and place is, what do we say yes to and what do we say no to? How are we going to be odd, intentionally odd in our cultural setting? What is it that the gospel calls us to do or to be that is going to be inexplicable to our neighbors? And then how is it that we are going to fit in, to join, to embrace what God is doing in our culture and in this moment? What do we say yes to and what do we say no to? And a little bit of what I'm hearing you say is, well, maybe we need to say no to some of these trends that I'm naming around disestablishment or around volunteerism. And I think that's a really good observation and good question. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I would just briefly say that the European church is an example that, frankly, Americans sort of sniffed at over the last few decades, because now attendance in church is, what, 10% of its membership at this point in Europe? We're going the same way. And yeah, we're doing very little about it, in my opinion. We've not set our own expectations, even within our own congregation, to a point where our financial giving, as well as our attendance, is on the decline. That's not the culture's fault. That's something we need to be attending to, in my opinion. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think I think that's definitely something worth thinking about, because this is a little bit of a side note in relationship to that. But I think one of the responses, particularly of mainline churches in the United States, to religious disestablishment has been a quest to be an establishment church. So the United States never really had Christendom the way Europe has had Christendom, right? To be Christian was to be baptized and to be European in the European sort of state church system. In the United States, citizenship and Christian affiliation were sort of two separate things. We had a kind of cultural Christendom, right? But that didn't stop the desire of our religious leaders to tether Americanness to Christianness, to have the church be a kind of establishment institution. And I think, you know, there's some beautiful things that have come out of that. There's also some ways that I think our church systems have distorted our understanding of Christian identity. So when we ask people, I could get in trouble for this, let me just give an example. When we ask people to be a member of the church and to participate as part of their discipleship, or we call them to be disciples, we usually call them to serve on a committee, right? to sit on a board, to run a committee, to follow Robert's rules of order, to make some decisions. And that's what we do because we think of ourselves as establishment institutions, and this is how you run established institutions, and you dole out money and you run the kind of projects and stuff like that. And it's such a, especially in Presbyterianism, it's such a deep part of our self-understanding, right? Because we have largely been the establishment church full of people that run establishment institutions and an upper middle class kind of denomination, right? Predominantly white. And in the racial dynamics of the United States, that has meant certain kinds of things. And we are no longer an establishment institution, but we still think of ourselves as one. And so, you know, my wondering about calls to discipleship is what are we actually calling people to when we call them to participate in the church? And maybe it's time to not call people to serve on committees, but to call people into some other way of participating in community. And I think, you know, church systems that have not been at the center of the establishment might give us some clues as to what that looks like. New immigrant churches, the African-American church, you know, structured very differently in how they think about participation. Okay, but that's, we'll get to that in a little bit. Let me jump into our next two images. So the next two are going to be, I'm thinking more about, when I talked about post-Christendom and then post-Christian. I distinguished those two last week to say post-Christendom is talking about these dramatic shifts in culture that have sort of decentered the church as a cultural institution. Post-Christian is a way of talking about the fact that even people in our own churches find Christianity less plausible, right? That there's a kind of struggle to understand what the faith is about, even for those that call themselves Christian. And so the next two images are focused a little bit more on these changes that are happening internally in our churches as well. So the first image is air, that the air we breathe is the air of secularity, that we live in what Charles Taylor, a philosopher, would call a secular age. And there's a couple different ways that we think about secularity or secularism. And I want to kind of parse these two out because I think understanding this helps us to better name the challenges that we face as a church to say, you know, as we even try to communicate who we are and what we're about to our neighbors and to those gathered in our communities. So the first image of secularism is this way of thinking about cultural shifts that have happened really throughout the 20th century, but culminating more recently in terms of just the decline of the importance of religion for how we think about living a full and a meaningful life. So even as far back as the 1940s in Germany, Dietrich Bonhoeffer uses this language in his letters and papers from prison. So if you remember the story of Bonhoeffer, I guess he's kind of a big deal right now with the movie and everything. So you probably all do know the story, but he was a German theologian who was outspoken, part of the resistance, the Christian resistance to National Socialism. Was part of the Confessing Church, they called it. He was imprisoned in the middle of World War II for his role in a plot against the German government, and was sentenced to death. And he wrote letters and papers from prison. Exchanges. He didn't write letter. He was writing letters in prison. There's a published volume, Letters and Papers from Prison, and it's really interesting. This brilliant, faithful theologian wrestling with the dynamics of the mid 20th century from, you know, behind bars without all of his other books and everything in these exchanges. And there's some really brilliant and insightful stuff that's in Letters and Papers from Prison. But he in that he talks about what characterizes modernity is that we have pushed God to the margins because our human self-confidence has come of age. We now master so much of the world, right? We've mastered so much of knowledge and making our environments more comfortable and food production and transportation. We have mastered the world. We are now a world come of age. And so he says it this way: human beings have learned to manage all important issues by themselves without recourse to working hypothesis God. In very different forms, the Christian apologetic is now moving against this self-confidence. It is trying to persuade this world that has come of age that it cannot live without God as its guardian. Even after we have capitulated on all worldly matters, there still remain the so-called ultimate questions, death, guilt, which only God can answer, and for which people need God and the church to pastor. And then he later, in a later letter, he says, one only learns to have faith by living in the full this worldliness of life. And so what Bonhoeffer is noticing here, you can't quite tell by the quote, but he's actually very critical. He predicts the decline of the church because he thinks the church is not responding adequately to a world come of age. What he's basically saying in this quote and then later on is that as modern society has become more and more competent at mastering the things that used to sort of crush, you know, other civilizations, the church has been running around saying, yes, but you can't solve the problem of death yet, and so you still need us. And he calls this a God of the gaps, right? That we just kind of keep slipping God into the gaps in our understanding. And as the world becomes master, you know, as modernity masters more and more things, we have these smaller and smaller gaps in which to sort of fit God. And what he says is only in the church learning to embrace the this worldliness of life, that can the church sort of find a place again, only in becoming capable of taking in the wholeness of modern life and not just the little gaps that are sort of left to it. And so he has this phrase he calls religionless Christianity. He's got all these ways he's trying to play with what he imagines needs to be a massive reimagining of the Christian faith in order to connect it with modern life. Now, there's a lot of debate about what Bonhoeffer meant by that. And like, you know, there's the evangelical interpretation and there's the liberal interpretation. And as with all things to now, they're very polarized and very different. But what I think Bonhoeffer is naming for us is one of the very typical ways we think of secularization and secularity, which is as the world has become more and more technologized, if we might use that term, as we've learned to master more and more of the natural world and modern life becomes more and more complicated, it becomes harder to fit belief in God sort of into that. You know, that would be the original sort of secularization thesis, which has now been largely debunked by experience. But we still in the West kind of hold on to this, of some popular version of this thesis, which is, in a world in which we can get into a steel tube and fly at 30,000 feet, it's really hard to believe in God. It would be the simplest way to say that. And so what the church has done is, well, we'll leave aeronautics to the engineers, and we'll leave, you know, healing to the doctors, but we'll kind of take, you know, this private meaning-making thing called faith and hold on to that. So Bonhoeffer was critical of that, but that is still one reality of modern life. Now, I think more recent interpretations of the secularization theory would agree with Bonhoeffer, but then say what has actually happened is not the disenchantment of the world, but the misenchantment of the world. So we still see a lot of religious fervor, right? It's just not in church. It's at, you know, it's at Heinz Field, or it's at the sort of, you know, rock show, you know, at PPG Paints Arena, or it's in front of the American flag, right? All the rituals around nationalism are kind of religious. They have a religious flavor to them. It's just not in the church. But I think there's a more complicated way to tell this story. And this comes from the work of a philosopher named Charles Taylor, who wrote a book called A Secular Age. And what Taylor argues is that there's you know, he has three different understandings of secularity. There's secularity one, which is this idea that there's the religious and the secular, right? There's a part of the world that is non-religious. You know, there's a distinction that comes out of the Middle Ages that there's, you know, there's secular vocations and there's religious vocations, that kind of thing. Secular two would be the decline of religion as the world modernizes, religion becomes less and less important. It can't explain as much. It gets kind of put into the gaps. That's the Bonhoeffer definition. Secular three, Taylor says, is what we really need to pay attention to. And secular three is the change in what he calls the background conditions of modernity. So he explains it most simply like this. So in 1500 CE, if you showed up to, you know, to the village cafe or whatever and said, I do not believe in God, people would, they might have you institutionalized, right? It would be a very bizarre thing to say. Of course, there were heretics. Of course, there were people that had views that were outside of the norm, but it was almost unimaginable to not believe in God. And someone that didn't believe in God would be seen as socially suspect, like deficient in some way, right? Dangerous. Now, when he was writing in 2008, if you show up at the local village cafe and you say, I believe in God, people are going to say, well, tell me, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? That's very interesting. And you would have to defend your belief in God. Or sometimes perhaps defend your disbelief in God. But the change in the background conditions is such that now we can imagine belief and disbelief. It's completely, it's not unimaginable to us that someone can show up and say, I don't believe in God. We don't assume that there's something deficient with them. We don't want to institutionalize them. We don't think that they are morally suspect. We think you can be actually a good human and not believe in God. We have lots of evidence of that, right? Of exclusive humanists that do good things in the world that don't believe in God. We also have lots of evidence of people that believe in God and do lots of damage in the world. And so we can like, you know, the background conditions of belief for Taylor have changed. And that actually changes how we think about our own faith, because we can imagine not believing. And so belief becomes a choice rather than just the way we imagine the world. And so this understanding of secularity, that we live in an age that is secular, an age in which belief can be chosen or not chosen, actually has significant impacts on what it means to be a Christian and significant impacts on how we even see ourselves. And this is something that we have yet to really confront, I think. Let me explain this just a little bit more and then I'll pause. So Taylor tells a very elaborate story about what it means to live in a secular age. But I think some of this can be important for thinking through you know, how we inhabit this space. He talks about modern secularity as a product of Christendom. It's actually a kind of radicalization of particular Christian ideas and practices that have created this new age in which belief or disbelief is a viable option. And he calls this the modern moral order, that there's a kind of moral order that characterizes our life in modernity that actually has institutionalized this condition of unbelief and belief. And so he characterizes the modern moral order around a couple different things. The first is recognizing that over the last couple hundred years, we've created a very flat religious and social space. So if you think about you know, the role that festivals would have played in medieval times as sort of disruptions in the chronos and the logical kind of, you know, marching on of time, and these unique moments that connect us to the divine and connect us to our past in ways that sort of jump out of the chronological movement of time. So like Easter, Easter Sunday in 2025 is closer to the original event of Easter than just an ordinary day in, you know, 60 CE or something like that, right? This idea that time is both vertical and horizontal, right? There's the Kairos time, there's Chronos time. If you think about how social hierarchies would function, that you had religious vocations in which people were higher up on the chain of being, closer to the will of God, that would then dispense, you know, priests that would then dispense the goodness of God to those that were underneath them. And those in the secular vocations would provide the kind of, you know, provide for the food and the economic well-being of the priests or those with higher religious vocations closer to God, right? Things of like the great chain of being. Well, when the Protestant Reformation happens, one of the primary ideas of the Protestant Reformation is the priesthood of all believers, which we're all here and probably think this was largely a good thing, right? That there aren't higher and lower vocations. There's simply the vocation to be a human being. And that at the foot of the cross, we are all equal. And that God has gifted each of us to participate in God's kingdom and God's reign, to participate in God's mission in ways that are unique to us and unique to our situation. And so we don't want priests that are somehow closer to God, that dispense God's goodness, but rather all of us through Christ have equal access to God. All of us have equal access to the truth of God in the Word of God, right? These radical leveling ideas of the Reformation, Taylor says, also get practiced in what he calls the modern moral order, which is a radical flattening of us with one another. So we are now equal before God, but also a flattening of time in which all time is the same. You know, we don't have this sense of the festivals somehow connecting us in unique ways, but they're just kind of one more day that we do some things and all that kind of stuff. So thinking about this kind of radical flattening. Another dimension of the modern moral order is the pursuit of one's own well-being by way of economic exchange and the long march of liberative rights. So, you know, what happens in the flattening after the Reformation is also some of the processes that eventually create capital, you know, our certain kind of economic environment, where rather than fighting with one another with weapons, we fight with one another in economic competition. And the economy becomes the primary mode by which we express our well-being. So the stock market, you know, a very now recent reality, the stock market becomes one of the primary ways we judge whether we're doing well or not. This kind of very abstract sort of thing, but the reading of the stocks at the end of the day is this kind of almost like pagan ritual of whether the gods are smiling on us or not, right? But this assumption that it's the economy by which we work out our well-being, and the economy being a realm for liberty, right? A realm for us to make our own choices, to pursue our own bliss, to construct our own identities. And that, for Taylor, is connected to what he calls the long march of liberation, liberation from, from gender hierarchies, liberation from religious hierarchies, liberation from sexual norms, liberation from racial hierarchies or whatever. Like there's a whole, this long march of individual liberations that are able to be expressed economically and able to be expressed socially. And he calls it a long march because at every level, that same liberative logic gets kind of applied to an ever new place. Now, again, we would say that this is largely good, right? Lots of beautiful things have come into the world when people have realized that they have agency, that they are beloved by God, and that that we are equal before the law and all these kinds of things. And yet one of the consequences, again, in this modern moral order is that identity becomes something that each of us has to construct on our own. As everything gets leveled and as everyone becomes liberated individuals, No longer can I say, who am I? Well, I am the son of Jim Hagley and the grandson of Albert Hagley and the great grandson of, you know, and I keep going back. And, you know, because my great grandfather was a farmer and my father was a farmer, then I am a farmer. My father was not a farmer, but, you know, and I am a farmer, right? That we think of, we don't think of identity in that way anymore. Right? Who am I? Well, I am a male. And so being male means that I have to do this or I live this and I don't express myself that way or whatever. We don't have those kinds of norms, traditions, kind of institutions that sort of structure life and identity. And in a lot of ways, that's beautiful. But in other ways, it's terrifying because it's like we're on a boat in the middle of the ocean and we're told to paddle to shore, but it's open horizon in every direction. Right. And so this is another dimension of the modern moral order. And so let me just around identity. So Christianity then becomes one tool among many for identity construction. And so we'll borrow from this piece of Christianity, we'll borrow from this from Buddhism, and we'll borrow from this from something we saw on TikTok, and then that's who we are. And Taylor would say, this is just what the modern world is at this point. This is what it means to be in a secular age, this demand of choice. It's not that we get to choose, it's that we have to choose, right? The third then is this liberated and disciplined individual establishes his or her identity through increasingly self-referential processes, what he calls the buffered self. So the self of medieval times was a self that was porous, right? So I was shaped by my tradition. I was shaped by my family. I could be assaulted by an evil spirit or a good spirit, right? Sickness was seen as often something that had to do with the spirits or other kinds of things. We could put curses on people. You could be cursed and you could be blessed. Now our modern conception of the self is not porous, but buffered. We are primarily agents. We are individual entities that get to make choices and to act on the world rather than the world acting on us. Does that make sense? And again, this has dimensions for then what it means to be a Christian. If we are buffered selves making choices, acting on the world, there's a whole bunch in the Christian tradition that assumes we are porous selves, right? We are images of God, meaning we reflect who God is. We are not little mini gods running around, right? We are saved in our connection to Jesus Christ. Christ chooses us before we choose Christ. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that Christianity assumes a kind of porousness of the self, a kind of participatory understanding of what it means to be human and what it means to be in community. And yet the modern assumption of the self is something very different. And again, I don't think our churches have fully reconciled that. We've kind of given ourselves over to this buffered self imagination, individual choosers acting on the world. And I think this becomes a challenge for discipleship, to think about where are we going to say no to this perhaps, or where are we going to carve out a different kind of imagination? And then finally, that our whole buffered self life is a this worldly, it's focused on this worldly flourishing. There's no real imagination for kind of heaven necessarily, but about, you know, the materials of the faith being, or of any part of our life being focused on flourishing in a sort of this worldly way. And so he calls that the immanent frame. Okay, this is a lot. Let me, here's a quote where he sort of ties a bunch of these things together. He says, our sense of being comprehensively in secular time is very much reinforced by the thick environment of measured time in which we have woven ourselves, around which we have woven ourselves in our civilization. Our lives are measured and shaped by accurate clock readings without which we couldn't function as we do. This thick environment is both the condition and consequence of our far-reaching attempt to make the best of time, to use it well, not to waste it. It is the condition and consequence of time becoming for us a resource, which we have to make use of wisely and to take advantage. So the buffered identity of the disciplined individual moves in a constructed social space where instrumental rationality is a key value and time is pervasively secular. All of this makes up what I want to call the immanent frame. So it's a kind of profound way of thinking about what it feels like to be alive in modernity, isn't it? Let me pause. Like, how does this strike you? Does this kind of intuitively, even if you can't trace kind of all the intellectual connections he's making, because it's like an 800-page book I tried to summarize with one slide, but even if you can't make all the connections, does this feel like what it means to be alive right now? Any comments or, yeah. Oh yeah, sorry, we need the mic. I should have, thank you.
Yes, I think it does. I'm trying to understand my daughter.
Yeah.
And so I think our generation probably is a group that feels a loss of some of these ways that we identify ourselves.
Yeah.
And we have trouble passing that on or explaining it to our children and even younger people. Mm-hmm. And I try to imagine what their worldview is, and it's much different. I see they have so many choices.
Yeah.
And when people talk about what's happening with the youth today, I think they are feeling very lost and anxious because all these choices are forced upon them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really well said. And so I'm a Gen Xer. I'm a young Xer, so almost a millennial. And I look at my college age kids and I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I was born when I was born, you know, because all of this just keeps intensifying with media and all that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, as soon as I start launching in on TikTok or phones, my kids start rolling their eyes, you know. And but I think they have also told me, when we have kids, we're not letting them touch a screen until they're like 20, you know, because they realize what it's done to them, right? Yeah, so I think, you know, but I think like technology and like our media environment and all that has taken what Taylor does and then amplified it in ways that even though all of us grew up in what Taylor would consider a secular age, that secularity has intensified, right? And also, interestingly enough, religiosity has intensified, but in ways that are attentive to this level of choice. And so I think one of the more interesting things about Taylor's theory is how he talks about then the ways that we engage, the kind of triangulation that is happening with the fact that we still have deep religious urges, right? So the buffered self, the modern moral order, the immanent frame doesn't take away the fact that what it means to be human is to long to give ourselves to something, to long for transcendence. So the fact that we have traded the cathedral for Heinz Field is, you know, in some ways predictable. We're going to express this urge to worship, to participate in something transcendent in some way, shape, or form. It's just not happening in the church anymore. And it's something we are freely choosing to do in any variety of ways, rather than being sort of ushered into this assumed way that, you know, this is assumed that this is what it means to be human, or that the church is where we find God, or something like that. So Taylor talks about, you know, that there, he kind of divides modern society into three different responses to the immanent frame. The first on the top he calls the beyonders, and these are people that are freely choosing. I mean, you all in some way, shape, or form are beyonders, right? You're in church on a Sunday when you could be, you know, reading the New York Times at a cafe somewhere, or, you know, at the gym or whatever, right? You're here and not there. And so beyonders are those that in the midst of the immanent frame are still making some kind of claim for transcendence, some kind of orientation toward there is a God. Life is about more than what's here, and I'm trying to connect myself to that. Now, I still think it's very difficult for us to get ourselves outside of the immanent frame. So the ways that the fact that we are freely choosing to be here changes the nature of that belief, right? because our framework still has a kind of relativity to it. God maybe is there, maybe is not. Maybe we meet God this way, maybe we meet God that way. The fact and nature of this kind of radical pluralism changes even what it means to be a beyonder. But then you have on the left what he calls the exclusive humanists. And so these are the full participants in the modern moral order, and their form of transcendence is committing themselves to a humanist kind of moral framework. So you think of largely the a-religious left, or even many people on the religious left, fully committed to the flourishing of human beings, understood in the terms of the modern moral order, making it possible for people to freely choose, you know, whatever it is they want, but without any reference to a deity, to transcendence, to anything outside of the imminent frame. It's you know, we want our best life, our fullest like expression of ourselves here and now. And then on the right, he calls them the neo-Nietzschean anti-humanists. So people for whom the imminent frame basically takes away all possible moral frameworks, and it's the struggle of all against all, the will to, the Nietzschean kind of will to power. And so this would be the a-religious right. Some of the stuff that's being written right now about the manosphere or UFC or some of these kinds of things, this is a kind of expression, an amoral expression of human identity, in which in a world without a transcendent other, rather than be soft, you know, exclusive humanists trying to make room for everyone else, what we really need to do is be realistic about how the world works, throw our elbows and make room for ourselves, right? And so you have, religious groups that can fall on either side. You know, the right, the religious right would fall on a little bit more on the anti-humanist side. The religious left fall a little bit more on the humanist side. And what Taylor says is that in this kind of triangulation, what often happens is the two sides, you often find the two sides teaming up on the other side. So the religious left and the left teaming up against the anti-humanist, the religious right and the right teaming up against. And so there's this kind of, it's a way of explaining our polarization as part of what is happening here in the imminent frame. And I'm not going to go more into that, but I think this is a really interesting way of thinking about even how our churches have to sort of play. You really can't live on any corner. You're kind of always playing on one of the sides in between. Okay, so the image of air, that what we are, we live in a secular age, and that makes the demand of choice and identity construction and any kind of religious commitment, it puts it in terms that are different from the terms that the faith has been nurtured over the last centuries. The last image is the image of foreclosure, or the kind of the structures of the image of home, the structures and institutions that we have relied upon, that we have built, that our faith has built. So I'm thinking our denominational bodies, our congregational structures, our leadership structures, all of the kind of form that we've given to our faith in the United States over the last couple hundred years is going through a moment of declaring bankruptcy, a kind of moral bankruptcy, we might say. And what I want to say is that the institutions and structures of Western Christendom have been unable to accommodate to a pluralist world and to a Christian, accommodate a pluralist world with a Christian faith would probably be the best way to say that. So there's a kind of intellectual moral bankruptcy in our inability to structure a faith that can respond to the kind of pluralism that characterizes the modern world. Let me explain that a couple ways. So up here, the picture that I have up here is from the Room of Constantine in the Vatican. And if you've ever been in the room of Constantine, you walk in and here's, this is the first fresco you see, and that's Constantine standing. He sees the vision of the cross. And if you remember the story of Constantine, 313, not 313, what was the year? 312. He's going to be fighting at the Battle of Milvian Bridge for control of the empire. He has this dream where Jesus appears to him in the dream, and he sees the cross, and it says, "By this conquer." At this point, Christianity is illegal in the Roman Empire. Constantine wakes up in the morning. He puts Kairos, the letter Chi and the letter Rho, which are the first two letters of Christ. He puts Kairos on the Roman shields, and they win the Battle of Milvian Bridge. He takes over Rome, and he unites the empire. And then later on, he makes Christianity legal. And this is sort of, now, this is probably not true, right? This is written in, Eusebius writes about this. If you go to the column in Rome that's still standing, that celebrates the victory at Milvian Bridge, there are no Christian symbols on it. But we do know that Constantine eventually makes Christianity legal, that he has a late life conversion, that he is baptized. But if you know, so here's this first scene of the conversion of Constantine, the winning of a battle by the power of the cross, which is an interesting image. And then if you kind of keep going around the room, you start seeing like somewhere over on this side, there's darkness and there's the pagans in darkness. And there's the Roman soldiers coming with their swords, and they're slaughtering the pagans that are in darkness. And the image is that God bestows upon Constantine this power. And Constantine then, in the power of God, goes and wins the world for Jesus, right? Wins the world for Christ. And what winning the world for Christ looks like is slaughtering the pagans. And this is the room of Constantine. And in a lot of ways, the history of Christian interaction with those that are our religious and ethnic and racial others has been shaped by this kind of imagination, right? The divine gift of God given to some to make the world better, to make the world right, and then the accomplishment of that by force, if necessary. So there's an African historian, Jihu Hensels, who talks about the fact that we have to think about European Christendom as a kind of tribal faith, in the sense that God has gifted our tribe, you know, stemming from the conversion of Constantine and then on to the missionization of the northern tribes of Europe. Every time new groups were missionized by the Romans or by those in southern Europe, they were mass conversions, where they would go to the leaders of different people groups. They would convert the leaders, then the whole tribe would convert. And so this is why we have all these kind of European neo-pagan holidays that become Christian holidays, because they just flip them over, right, into mass conversion. So there's a kind of tribal religious identity that really shaped European Christendom. And so the history of mission, one way of reading that is that it was about the expanding of the European tribal identity into other parts of the world. And so Hensel says it this way: at stake in the expansion of Christianity was not only the salvation of non-Christian peoples, but also the dignity and supremacy of the sending tribe or Christian nation. As we have seen, the conception of Christianity as a territorial faith also engendered a bifocal vision of the world in which the kingdom of Christ on earth was a visible, self-defined territorial reality in contradistinction to the heathendom or the territories of unbelievers. Since Europe was representative of the church, mission involved efforts to spread the gospel in non-European lands. Now, I don't mean this to just say all Christian mission was terrible everywhere and all times. But what I do mean to say is that there's a kind of undercurrent that we have not always been critical of, in which the expansion of the faith has been seen as the expansion of a particular way of life and a particular identity. You know, so making the world English or making the world American, and Christianity being sort of part of how that was how that was done. And the real challenge that this is as an uncritical subterranean kind of dimension of how we've the Christian faith in the West has related to the non-Western world. One of the critical dimensions of this is that now that the world is so small and so big at the same time, right? The world is on our doorstep all the time in ways that are unique to this time in history. It's not unusual for us to know people of multiple different religious faiths, multiple different racial and ethnic identities and histories and ways of life and languages. The school my kids went to in Vancouver had 80 different languages spoken in the school. A school of 700 kids, 80 different languages, right? This is not unusual now. That's a bit extreme, but this is not unusual now for life in our world. The world has become very small and very big all at the same time. The challenge is that we have a faith that doesn't always know how to relate to this difference apart from trying to assimilate it, make it like us, to erasing the difference, or casting it out, calling it dangerous, heathen, sinful, or whatever. And so we either try to make difference like us, or we curse it and send it out. And this, we have this tendency because of this history, right? Because of this, how the story of Constantine and other kinds of things have sort of shaped our theological imagination. And so we're unable to accommodate a pluralist world in a lot of ways. And then related to this is the fact that in the United States, our institutions have been built around notions of white supremacy. That we in the mainline church have been very, very slow to recognizing our complicity in sins of slavery and segregation and race, you know, and just kind of generalized racism. And so, I think there's been a reckoning among our young people looking at our institutions and saying, you have been so slow to respond to this. And now you put out statements, but you're still not really addressing it. And so, you know, people leave the church, name the church as being not only morally complicit, but morally bankrupt because of the history of race and racism in the United States. And I think, you know, there's been lots of good efforts by our churches to address this, but we haven't always been honest enough about the theological assumptions that have made us comfortable. And when I say us, I mean us white people, that have made us comfortable in a society like ours that has for so long sustained a kind of racial hierarchy. That Christianity has resources to critique it, but oftentimes the kind of Christianity that we have has been pretty comfortable with it, right? And so there's a theologian, Willie Jennings. I don't have his quote up there, but there's theologian Willie Jennings who talks a lot about this. He says, what we have inherited in the Christian faith in the West is, he calls it a diseased social imagination. We have trouble imagining what it means for us to belong to one another, to be a part of a genuinely pluralist democracy, and to see that as part of our faith and not a sense of difference that we need to overcome or assimilate or cast out. And this is born in the data. I'm over time. Robert P. Jones has a book, The End of White Christian America. He has another book, White Too Long, where he looks at the data to show that this is, if you are white and you are Christian in America, you are more likely to harbor racist ideas than if you're non-Christian and white. And I just think that's something that we need to reckon with. And so this last image of bankruptcy, you know, is such that some of the challenge is that there is some serious work that needs to be done within our churches about reimagining a kind of theological, reforming our theological imagination so that we can live faithfully within a pluralist democratic space like where we are now. Okay, that's a really bad place to end because that's really depressing. Let me pray for us, and then next week we're going to pick up the sort of what do we do now part of the conversation. Let me pray. Lord God, we come to you as people who want to understand what it means to be faithful to the good news in this time and in this place. We confess the ways in which we fall short, the ways in which we seek our own well-being rather than those of others and one another. I pray that you can, despite where we ended, that you can give us a sense of courage and encouragement as well, that you have not abandoned us or your church, that you do, by your Spirit, show us the way. In Christ's name, amen. All right. Thank you.